This is chapter 3 of Amazon Grace, the first and final cause, She Who Attracts. The writing that follows surges from an apparently strange blend of sources. 13th century philosophy / theology, together with late 20th and early 21st century analysis of impending / already occurring global atrocities. The contemporary analysis can be found in recently published books and journals, and, in a less reliable and trustworthy fashion, in ordinary media. My medieval sources are mainly the writings of Thomas Aquinas. In the face of the devastation already wrought and being planned in this century, trivial women can consciously participate in the ongoing weaving of webs of connectedness in the universe. We do this by diligently following our deep purpose, that is, our final cause. In a brief re-review of the Aristotelian and Thomistic concept of causality is no doubt in order. As I explained in Beyond God the Father, when Aristotle wrote of the final cause, he intended cause to mean that which brings about an effect. Scholastic philosophers followed the Aristotelian theory of the four causes to explain change. According to this theory, the material cause is that out of which something is made, as the wood in a table. The formal cause is that which determines its nature, as the shape of the wood, which makes it a table and not a chair or something else. The efficient cause is the agent that produces the effect by her/his/its action, as in the carpenter who produces the table. The final cause is the purpose which starts the whole process in motion, as the goal of having an object upon which to place books, papers, or other items. The final cause is therefore the first cause, since it moves the agent to act upon the matter, bringing forth a new form. There are more sophisticated examples than this, which reveal the complexity of the theory of the four causes. One needs simply to ask about the causes of the wood itself to glimpse the difficulties. The point I am stressing here, however, is the absolutely prior and primal role of the final cause. As a well-known scholastic axiom states, the final cause is the cause of causes, because it is the cause of the causality of all the other causes. Sounds like a tongue twister. Unfortunately, Aristotle and his followers developed this philosophy within a society that was imprisoned in a static worldview. The role of the efficient cause, agent, was seen as actualizing a potential that was already there and that had already been realized. There was no fully developed idea of evolution, of a real future, of an X factor. There was no quantum leap into the future. The final cause was the source of limited change, but everything was trapped in an ultimately changeless world. For wild, wicked women, realizing the final cause is something utterly other than this. The final cause in an infinitely spinning world. Under the gruesome rule of patriarchy, amazing Amazons are made to feel that we have lost our senses. We struggle to regain our sense of direction. This requires practicing spacecraft. As explained in Wickedary, spacecraft is the art of spinning beyond the compass. It is also skill in walking / talking the wrong way, moving in wicked directions, opening doors to other dimensions, other spatial perceptions. By reversing the reversals of the snoolish space controllers, we enter a different context. This is a meta-patriarchal space/time, beyond the measurements of compasses and maps. For anyone who has retained a primal memory of connectedness with the wild, the thought that she could be served from this, or that the wild itself could be destroyed, stirs ineffable feelings of horror. Although such severance and destruction have always been essential to the patriarchal agenda, they have rapidly escalated in recent years. An atmosphere of such impending evil has become ever more widespread and intense since the mid-1990s. One typical moment of manifestation of this escalation occurred in the U.S. in 2001, where on Sunday, June 10th, the New York Times sent discouraging shockwaves across the country in a front-page article by David Barboza announcing that experts see an inexorable spread of genetically engineered crops, making it almost impossible for consumers to avoid them. Reactions of environmentally sensitive activists to the article are indications that it struck a nerve. As one committed environmentalist wrote, "This is just so painful to read. I feel as if a part of my being, my soul and body, has been yanked out of me, has been stolen and taken over by these companies." To which another activist responded, "The reason you feel this way is because it is true. After all, the idea that our souls/bodies are separate from the souls/bodies of the living world around us is an illusion." Barboza's article itself is a mixture of truth and deceptive manipulation. It is problematic that the truth about the spread of contamination has struck sensitive readers and caused great pain. By conveying a picture of total hopelessness, the author discouraged the will to fight back, to express opposition to genetic engineering. Presumably, in order to present a balanced account, the author cites a statement by longtime critic of biotechnology, Jeremy Rifkin, who is quoted as saying, "They're hoping there's enough contamination so that it's a fait accompli. But the liability will kill them. We're going to see lawsuits across the farm belt as conventional farmers and organic farmers find their product is contaminated." However, Rifkin's seemingly hopeful statement is sandwiched between the disheartening comments by biotech, i.e. Nectech supporters. Barboza's piece is a blend of information and disinformation. Yet the experience itself of reading such an article and attending to our reactions can on some level be encouraging, because it reveals the depth of our felt connection with the living world. In such painful moments of revelation of our connectedness, we sense that we have a choice. This article invites us not only to recognize the extent of the contamination caused by genetic engineering, but also to give up resisting. Barboza ends with a triumphal dismissal of zero tolerance, citing Jean Romero Severson, a professor of agriculture at Purdue University, who concludes, "If your standard is 100% pure, you better stop eating now." Trivial resistors will not stop eating, and we should not stop fighting. The final cause draws us onward, and it causes by attraction. When I speak of the final cause, I mean the indwelling, always unfolding goal or purpose perceived as good and attractive to one to act, to realize her own participation and being, the beginning, not the end of becoming, the first cause and cause of causes, which gives an agent the motivation to act, radical feminism, the cause of causes. In an ontological/theological language, the ultimate final cause is she who attracts. She is ultimate/intimate reality, the constantly unfolding verb of verbs who is intransitive, who has no object that limits her dynamism. She is the good who is self-communicating, who is the verb from whom, in whom, and with whom all true movements move. That is, she is, of course, being. Goddess the verb is hidden for two reasons. First, there is our condition of living in the foreground, the deadly state of reversal. In this state, our eyes have been dimmed and all of our senses numbered by reversal, which is defined in the Wikidary as the fundamental mechanism employed in the world construction and world maintenance of patriarchy, basic method employed in the making of patriarchal myths, ideologies, institutions, policies, and strategies. Mad, masterminded maneuver characteristic of mirrordom, inversion, turning everything inside out and upside down. Examples: A. The absurd story of Eve's birth from Adam. B. The belief that man is superior to animals. C. The worship of male divinity. D. The belief that radical feminist view is narrow and or dated. The second reason why the goddess is hidden is the inherent nature of the final cause, who is but is not yet, who is always unfolding. There is an element of surprise. We participate in her creation, knowing yet unknowing what we do. The final cause is an invitation and a challenge to keep on weaving and moving. Defying gravity, we fly in the face of the spreading evil. Moving on, we find new sisters / re-sisters. We discover and realize deeper and wider connections in the universe and spin in other directions. But this process is not simple. At times, the connections, the sisterhood especially, are not visible, tangible. Spanning the gaps. Sometimes, Websters, weavers, spinners lose our way, ourselves, in the process of trying to weave our way out of the reversal world that is patriarchy. We become lost, weaving around, spinning our wheels, floundering in a world of bad imitations. Through this experience, involving many events and much sorting out of temporarily lost memories and insights, often by reversing reversals, we find ourselves in another and wilder world, which is the world of the archaic future. We become luckier, better connected, so to speak, and more aware of synchronicities. Entering this new time/space, bewitching hags/harpies happen upon lost and found continent. The expression lost and found implies that some loss/losses precede the finding. Women under patriarchy have always suffered losses, of course, and wicked women have always been finding and refinding hidden treasures. It appears, however, that the early 21st century is a time of heightened experiences of losing and finding. An alarming example of the heightened experience of losing and finding. In my book, Outer Course, The Bedazzling Voyage, I discussed my experiences on the publication of Gynecology, 1979. I wrote and have always seen gynecology as part of a movement, including my own voyage, which has continued since that writing and continues because I am not a noun but a verb. When I set it free so it could be in the world, I did not see it as a work of perfection. For some women, it could be an awakening shock. For others, a source of information, or a springboard from which they might leap into their own amazing searches, words, and metaphors. Above all, I was acutely aware that I had not done or written everything. I had not written the last word. Otherwise, how could I ever write again? Rather, I had set free this book, this thunderbird, in the hope that its call would be heard. I hoped that it would soar together with the works of other women, which were coming and would come from different realms of the background. I looked forward to the profusion of new creation, which I believed would emerge from women of all races, cultures, classes, from all over this planet, speaking/be speaking out of our various and vital heritages. From my fourth galactic perspective, I see that this has happened and is happening because our time has come. Particularly moving to me personally is the work of women of Ireland, that treasure island which I recognize deeply as the wellspring of my background, my ancestral home. Especially gynergizing on a global scale is the new abundance of creation from women of color. Explosions of diversity do not happen without conflict, however. One of the responses to gynecology was a personal letter from Audre Lorde, which was sent to me May 1979. For deep and complex personal reasons, I was unable to respond to this lengthy letter immediately. However, when Lorde came to Boston to give a poetry reading that summer, I made a special effort to attend it and spoke with her briefly. I told her I would like to discuss her letter in person, so that we could have an adequate opportunity to understand each other in dialogue, and I suggested places where we might meet for such a discussion. Our meeting did in fact take place at the Simone de Beauvoir Conference Center in New York on September 29, 1979. In the course of that hour or so long meeting, we discussed my book and her response. I explained my positions clearly, or so I thought. I pointed out, for example, in answer to Audre Lorde's objection that I failed to name black goddesses, that gynecology is not a compendium of goddesses. Rather, it focuses primarily on those goddess myths and symbols which were direct sources of Christian myth. Apparently, Lord was not satisfied, although she did not indicate this at the time. She later published and republished slightly altered versions of her originally personal letter to me in anthologies as an open letter. It continues to be my judgment that public response in kind would not be a fruitful direction. In my view, gynecology is itself an open book. The writing of gynecology was for me an act of bibliophilic bonding with women of all races and classes under all the varying oppressions of patriarchy. Clearly, women who have a sincere interest in understanding and discussing this book have an obligation to read not only the statements of critics, but also the book itself, and to think about it. Letters, the Surge of Bibliophilic Bonding. Throughout the horrors of the academented witch craze, the letters responding to gynecology came to me. They came to me like healing balm. Reading many of them was and continues to be like sampling the most infinite variety of exquisite wines. They renewed slash renew my spirit. The letters conveyed many complex things. Simply stated, they poured out love and gratitude, and they told me that the long struggle had not been in vain. They gave me something back, renewed hope, courage, and strength. They surged up from the subliminal sea with messages of bibliophilic bonding. Profoundly differing in tone and intent from these letters is Audre Lorde's piece, Open Letter, which, as I wrote in Outer Course, has continued to be assigned as required reading by not a few professors in academia to students in the classes where gynecology itself has not been assigned, or a mere handful of pages of this book have been required reading. This kind of selectivity is irresponsible. It imposes a condition of self-righteous ignorance upon students, often within the setting of women's studies. This is, in my view, a worst-case scenario of pseudo-scholarship. It is, even if well-intentioned, divisive, destructive. It functions, at least subliminally, in a self-protective statement about the purity and political correctness of the professor. It can be analyzed in further detail as a manifestation of the seven-point sado-ritual syndrome as described in Gynecology, pages 130 to 133. My lost and found letter to Audre Lorde. On September 22, 1979, I wrote to Audre Lorde responding to her letter of May 6, 1979 to me. She denied ever receiving this, insisting throughout the years, as she altered and republished her original letter to me, that I had never responded to her initial correspondence. Nearly a quarter of a century later, my lost letter to Audre Lorde, with my last name written in Lorde's handwriting in the left bottom corner, was found amid her personal papers posthumously by her biographer, Alexis DeVoe, and documented in DeVoe's Warrior Poet, a biography of Audre Lorde. The text of my letter is as follows. September 22nd, 1979. Dear Audrey. First, I want to thank you for sending me The Black Unicorn. I have read all of the poems, some of them several times. Many of them moved me very deeply. Others seemed farther from my own experience. You have helped me to be aware of different dimensions of existence, and I thank you for this. My long delay in responding to your letter by no means indicates that I have not been thinking about it. Quite the contrary. I did think that by putting it aside for a while, I would get a better perspective than at first reaction. I wrote you a note to that effect, which didn't get mailed since I didn't have your address. Then there was hope of trying to get to Vermont in August, but the summer was overwhelmingly eventful. Clearly, there's no simple response possible to the matters you raise in your letter. I wrote gynecology out of the insights and materials most accessible to me at the time. When I dealt with myth, I used commonly available sources to find what were the controlling symbols behind Judeo-Christian myths in order to trace a direct line to the myths which legitimate the technological horror show. But of course, to point out this restriction in the first passage is not really to answer your letter. You have made your point very strongly, and you most definitely do have a point. I could speculate on how gynecology would have been affected had we corresponded about this before the manuscript went to press, but it doesn't seem creativity conducting to look backward. There is only now and the hope of breaking barriers between us, of constantly expanding the vision. I wonder if you will have any time available when I come to New York for the Simone de Beauvoir conference. Since I have a lot to do here, I had thought of just flying down Friday morning and returning that night. Are you free Friday afternoon or evening? Or will you be in Boston anytime soon? I called and left a message on your machine. My number is... .. Hope to see you and talk with you soon. Handwritten. I hope you're feeling well, Audrey. May the strength of all the goddesses be with you. Mary. I wrote this letter with the intention of communicating from one feminist to another without thinking about publishing it or preserving it for archives, so I did not focus on making a copy or saving it to prove its existence. In 1979, I saw no need to make a carbon copy or go out to a copy shop before mailing my letter to Audre Lorde. Imagine my surprise nearly a quarter of a century later when, on June 9, 2003, I was contacted by Alexis DeVoe, who was asking my permission to quote from my unacknowledged and apparently lost letter of September 22, 1979. It was astonishing after all these years to see someone, in fact, Audre Lorde's own biographer, say that she had seen my letter among Lorde's personal papers. It was gratifying to read that DeVoe felt it was essential to publish my letter to Lorde in order to do justice to the historical record, especially in light of the widespread public accusations and attacks resulting from Lorde's open letter. DeVoe was also determined to correct the prevailing belief that I had not answered Lorde's letter and to honor the truth of my reply. Realizing our connectedness and powers of creation. Some trivial women, shocked by the intensity of lost and found experiences, proclaim that this must be the time of times for manifestations of transspatial, transtemporal, and intergalactic consciousness. We sense that we are not alone in the universe, so we are not hopelessly lost. If we are desperate and daring, we can continue to follow the call of the wild. Such proclamations are most likely followed in the minds of many readers by thoughts introduced by the word but. There are innumerable obstacles that women contemplate when preparing to make the quantum leaps required to bond in sisterhood, save life on Earth, and have fun as well. The many blocks arising mostly arising from the state of oppression include depression, anxiety, loneliness, sickness, isolation, exhaustion, poverty, and the psychic/spiritual sabotage that accompanies and is engendered by all of these conditions. The blocks are expressed in buts, example, but I am depressed, lonely, tired, afraid, etc. Ad nauseam. Such blocks, real and imagined, are the sources of the buts, which in turn engender more blocks. Readers are invited to add their own list of blocks and buts, thereby clearing the air. Silly women focusing on our final cause increasingly realize our connectedness in being. We do not feel alone because we can sense the benevolent presences nearby. We can leap with confidence, relaxing in the knowledge that we participate in a web of relationships with a unified whole. This shift in emphasis from the parts to the whole has been exhibited in quantum physics since the 1920s. In the words of Werner Heisenberg, one of the originators of quantum physics, the world appears as a complicated tissue of events, in which connections of different kinds alternate or overlap or combine and thereby determine the texture of the whole. Fritjof Capra makes the point that quantum theory never ends up with things. It always deals with interconnections. This conceptual shift from the parts to the whole pervaded other fields in the 20th century as well. The first half of the century, the ideas of organismic biologists helped to give rise to systems thinking. Capra explains. According to this view, the essential properties of an organism or living system are the properties of the whole, which none of the parts have. They arise from the interactions and relationships among the parts. In recent decades, biologists have been forced to acknowledge the importance of cooperation in the evolutionary process. This presents a radical shift of perception away from the conventional evolutionary theory, especially that of 19th century Darwinists who saw only competition in nature. Biologist Lynn Manguilis shows that in contrast to conventional theorists, who saw the unfolding of life as a process in which species continually diverge from one another, some modern biologists and ecologists are beginning to see continual cooperation and mutual dependence among all life forms as essential to evolution. As Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan write in their refreshing view, life did not take over the globe by combat, but by networking. Drawing upon the work of Margulis and environmentalist James Lovelock, Fritjof Capra shows that in their Gaia theory, these thinkers have explored the planetary dimensions of the unfolding of life. Capra points out that our focus is shifting from evolution to co-evolution, an ongoing dance that proceeds through the subtle interplay of competition and cooperation, creation and mutual adaptation. So whatever happened to the final cause? Capra continues to soar in his analysis of the evolutionary unfolding of life over billions of years. He explains, driven by the creativity inherent in all living systems, expressed through three distinct avenues, mutations, the trading of genes, and symbiosis, and honed by natural selection, the planet's living patina expanded and intensified in forms of ever-increasing diversity. Then something strange seems to happen in his thought process. After acknowledging his intellectual debt to Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan, he suddenly announces, there is no evidence of any plan, goal, or purpose in the global evolutionary process, and thus no evidence for progress. Yet there are recognizable patterns of development. What seems to be going on here is a reduction of final causality to plan, goal, or purpose, and an easy dismissal of the whole package on the basis that there is a lack of empirical evidence. The classical concept of final causality is not even deemed worthy of mention. This reduces the analysis to the level of modern philosophy and Newtonian physics, which completely ignore the pivotal role of the cause of causes. Such reductionism also marks the 21st century pseudo-debate between creationism and evolution, making this seem to be an either-or situation. What proponents on both sides fail to recognize is that there is an utterly other way of thinking about these problems. There is no lack of evidence for final causality, but this cannot be understood with the reductionist level of empirical evidence. When I write a book, for example, I sense a beckoning, a calling to bring this work into being. I am motivated deep in my soul to produce this work, which is an outpouring of my soul. This calling slash beckoning is an invitation to realize my participation in being through the creation of this particular work, which is in itself a beckoning to others to realize their selves through their own creativity. What kind of evidence is there for the calling of the final cause, which is the realization of creativity? The answer lies in the realm where philosophy and mysticism meet. I can know that this process is happening, and this gives me intimations of the creativity of universe. It is my own experience of the cause of causes that opens the way to my conscious participation in the creation of the universe, and consequently to my real communication with other beings. It opens the way to the expansion of joy. This process of consciously participating in the attractive power of the final cause demands lusty leaps of courage to create. And this brings us leaping around further to deeply hearing and naming the goddess the verb. Naming goddess the verb. She is goddess of many names. Perhaps now, especially, we are called to hear her fiercest name, which is Nemesis. Nemesis. We'll read more in next chapter.